Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you.
My guest this week is Michael Lewis. Michael's the author of many New York Times bestselling books on a variety of subjects, such as financial markets, politics, and sports. His books, The Blind Side, Moneyball, and The Big Short, were each adapted for the screen, and each was nominated for an Academy Award. Michael's a columnist for Bloomberg View, a contributing writer to Audible, and his articles have appeared in Vanity Fair, The New York Times Magazine, Sports Illustrated, and a variety of other magazines. Michael has a new podcast called Against the Rules. Prior to becoming an author, Michael worked at Salomon Brothers, an experience he described in his first book, Liar's Poker. In this interview, Michael tells the story of his career and dives deeply into several of his most notable books, including Moneyball, Liar's Poker, and The Undoing Project. Despite being discouraged from his thesis advisor at Princeton to pursue writing and consistent rejections from publishers, he always had a passion for writing, and he knew that it was only a matter of time before he left Wall Street to pursue it. We also discuss how Michael organizes his ideas, how he's been able to defy pigeonholing in his writing, how he is able to write about complex topics for those who are not expert in those topics, and a variety of other subjects.
Michael Lewis, welcome. It's great to speak with you. Thank you so much for taking time with me.
Yeah, pleasure to do it.
Excellent. So, Michael, I thought I wanted to begin at the beginning, at least, in terms of your career and your beginnings as an author. You didn't go to college thinking you would be an author.
No.
You went to Princeton University. You studied art history. As I understand it, you actually thought you would be an art historian and, in fact, sort of sought that professionally, but found that it didn't interest you as much, nor was it financially rewarding. and thus, you made a pivot to studying business. You went to the LSE.
So it was a little different than that.
Okay,
what happened was I didn't think in college that I was going to. I wasn't studying for an occupation. I fell in love with art history.
Okay.
And I didn't think much about where that was going to lead. I liked it so much. In fact, my thesis is right over there. That thing, that white and black thing, that's the first thing I ever wrote. And
wow.
It was serious, where I was really engaged with it. Never wrote for school newspapers or anything like that.
Mm.
And at the end of it, I said, I want to just keep doing that. And it was my thesis advisor who said, you don't really have a future here with this. And he was kind
of... meaning writing or...
Meaning both, actually.
Oh.
One was, he said that, look, he was being kind, but he said that the whole profession, the artist historical profession, was collapsing. Like, they were hiring fewer of them. The people who were in the tenure jobs were never going to leave. There weren't going to be any jobs. But I did say to him, well, what do you think of the writing and the thesis? And he said, put it this way, never try to make a living at it. He didn't think I was much of a writer either.
Cool.
But he was great. And the writing's not that good. But the fact is, I liked it so much. So I thought, at that point, I thought, try to write while you're doing other things. And I went and I worked for an art dealer in New York, and I apprenticed with a cabinet maker in New Jersey, and I led teenage girls in tours through Europe. I used my art historical education that way. And I did that for 2 years, a year and a half, and then I ended up at the London School of Economics for complicated reasons, following a girlfriend. But I also, while I was at Princeton, it did seem to me that if I was going to have to make it in the world, at some point I was going to have to learn economics, because that was the language that successful people spoke. All the ambitious kids in my class, with the exception of the science engineer people, they were all in the economics department.
Mm.
So it wasn't studying business.
I see. Okay.
The LSE, it was like, you didn't teach any business. They taught you learned economics. And some of it was relevant, some of it wasn't. This is a good kind of tool for thinking.
Did you enjoy it?
I really liked playing on the basketball team. I was the point guard, and we've lost in the national championship 2 years in a row, the undergraduate.
In the UK.
Yeah. And so we play, it was a bunch of Americans playing against Brits who kind of dribble like this. And we traveled all over Europe playing semi-professional teams and college teams. I really liked that. And I really liked some of the education. Really did like some of the education. My tutor was Mervyn King, who ended up being governor of the Bank of England. Loved him. So I learned a lot. And a job in Wall Street fell in my lap. But I was writing, or trying to write, from the moment I left Princeton. I was submitting magazine pieces that were mainly getting rejected. They were entirely getting rejected. I didn't get it. They weren't accepted for 2.5 years. But I just kept doing it because I just liked doing it.
And why weren't you discouraged? If your thesis advisor, somebody who has a pretty good sense for this, was discouraging you?
Well, he wasn't a professional writer.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. You know, it's a really good question why I thought this was... I tell you why. Actually, I do know why. Because I wrote letters to friends and to my parents, and people circulated them. Like, I they circulated them like a piece of writing. It's like, you got to read this. And I heard that this was happening, that your letters, like, everybody's reading them. So I just had a sense that I could entertain on the page and be interesting on the page. And the thesis advisor did say, it's the best thesis of your department. This is really great. He said, we're not going to give you the thesis prize because you actually don't have an academic career in front of you. I can see that just looking at you. The thesis prize is wasted on you. It's gone to someone else. But it was a really, he thought I could think. And so I don't know, you know, it is when you're 22 years old, your view of, you know, you aren't realistic. You're risk seeking. I didn't have a lot of feedback, but I had enough feedback. And when the magazine pieces were rejected, they're coming back from actual editors. I thought, wow, someone read it. And they would say things like, the in-flight magazine for Delta Airlines really isn't an appropriate place for a piece about homeless people in New York City. but it's actually pretty well written and it was interesting, you know, so I got some encouragement, whatever little encouragement that I got, it took me a long way. Mm-hmm. That was it. I was fuel efficient. And then finally stuff started to get published while I was at the LSE. So by the time I got to Solomon Brothers, I had some clips from The Economist and The Wall Street Journal. And already knew when I got to Solomon Brothers that it was a matter of time. It was just a matter of how long I was going to stay there before I bailed and became a writer.
Did you view your going into Solomon Brothers, did you view that as potentially a source of content? Obviously, it would
totally.
Become, okay.
So totally, because I actually proposed a piece on the absurdity of Solomon Brothers hiring David Stockman for whatever they paid him, millions of dollars a year, when he didn't know anything about Wall Street. He was a Washington guy. And to Michael Kinsley at the New Republic, who had to tell me, it's a really good idea for a piece, but if I let you write it, you're going to lose your job at Solomon Brothers. And so I thought, well, I won't write about that. But I was already thinking about that kind of thing. And I've always been the kind of writer who's responding to what's immediately around me. I wasn't that aware of that at the time, but if I was dropped in Solomon Brothers, of course I was going to write about Solomon Brothers. You know, what I didn't think is, oh, there's like a book about Solomon Brothers in this. Mm-hmm. That Liar's Poker, it didn't occur to me until, I don't know, 6 months before I left that there's really a book in this. And even if you go back, I got the book proposal for Liar's Poker. And it's very little, it's very different from the book. I sold it on the basis of a proposal. It's very different from the book that was written. It was not a memoir. I wasn't in the proposal. It was a history of Wall Street that ended in like what was happening now, how this happened on Wall Street. And I wasn't even a character. And then I sat down and I started to write it. I'm going to write my story and see how it goes. I don't know how that happened, but I started to write a book that was different from the proposal I sold. I said to the editor, who's still my editor, Star Lawrence at Norton, I've done something a little different. Will you look and just tell me whether to keep going or go back and do it the way I said I was going to do it? And he called and he said, just keep going. This is better. A lot better.
That's really great. So, and it was, you know, it was a Mark Twain's quote about writing what you know. You were present in.
It just seemed I was the world's authority on my experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was no
anxiety. And quite an interesting one it was.
And it was in the middle of the place. I mean, if you think about it, if you were going to place some writer, some 24-year-old writer, down in Wall Street in 1986, where would you put him to come out with the story of the age? I think there are two places. You'd put him right next to Michael Milken and watch the whole junk bond thing happening. Or you would have put him in, not just in Solomon Brothers. Solomon Brothers was a better place than Drexel, just generally for this material. But you'd have put him with the R group, the John Merriweather group in the middle of the, and that's, I was their sales arm. So I was in the middle, right in the middle of the firm. And very quickly was having conversations with the vice chairman of the firm and, you know, big people. So I was being taken seriously because I was in the right place in the firm. So I was sort of like where Wall Street was changing. So that made the story, you know, a much more interesting story. So I was really lucky. The material was great.
Yeah, absolutely. Were you worried about the reaction from your former employer?
I can remember when it came out, walking down the streets of Manhattan and looking to the tops of buildings to see if there were snipers. I remember thinking someone's going to shoot me because the very senior people were really pissed off. Everybody else thought it was funny. So I wasn't worried about like the mob coming for me. The people on the trading floor, I thought it was, well, their life, and they thought it was funny. Good friend didn't think it was funny. When I didn't occur to me to think about how they would respond until after I was done with it. And the truth is that when I walked out, I told them what I was doing. I didn't know exactly what I was doing. I was going to write a book about Wall Street. And they actually could have given a rat's ass. They said we're going to try to save you from yourself here. We really think it's a shame that you're going to ruin your career by trying to go do this when you can make a lot of money here. Mm-hmm. So that was their, I didn't think of them. I just didn't have them much in my mind when I was worried about it. Because in addition, at that point, Salomon Brothers was such a fractured place, broken. There were factions of it that were inside that were hostile to the guy who was running it. There were factions of it outside that had moved on. People felt betrayed by the leadership. And so nobody really felt loyalty wasn't like part of the deal. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking that much about it.
Yeah.
But then when it came out and it blew up, I thought, oh, no, I'm in trouble. Something's going to happen. I wasn't quite expecting this.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And it's amazing the extent to which the financial markets have been fodder for, I mean, so Liar's Poker, Panic, The Big Short, Boomerang, Flash Boys, at least to name a few. Right. It's probably not all the ones that have had sort of the financial markets.
Well, that's it. And in some ways, Moneyball.
Yes, I mean,
Moneyball
exactly.
Is looking at baseball through the lens of someone who's been in the financial markets.
Right, right, right.
Like inefficient markets, arbitrage opportunities, but the assets are baseball players.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what I think is, as has been noted elsewhere, is your gift of explaining remarkably esoteric topics and making it readable and interesting to the layperson, to the inexperienced person in the financial markets.
I guess that's true. People have said that. I always have thought that if it's a gift, the gift is not being afraid to seem a little ignorant and being able to remember what it feels like not to know these things, not to know what a collateralized debt obligation is. So that, and a lot of times when I walk in, I don't know anything. So I didn't really know. The Wall Street that I came back to for The Big Short was very different from the Wall Street I left. And people were willing to talk to me because I think they figured that I would be able to understand it eventually. But in the beginning, people were explaining it to me like they were explaining it to an idiot. And so I had the advantage of knowing what it felt like not to know. Mm-hmm. I was never in so deep where I spoke the lingo. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's it. That helps. Also, no, I think that I find that when I'm writing, sometimes really interesting moments in the writing process come when I realize that I don't understand something by the way I'm writing it. Like I'm skirting something, like I don't fully understand it. And it forces me into a headspace where, because I'm really trying to explain it to myself, I end up explaining it to the reader too. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happens.
And what's the source of your confidence? You know, in the Undoing Project, there were a couple different points in the book itself, but also in the press you were doing around it, where you were contrasting yourself from these two Jewish guys, sort of filled with angst. You know,
debating. One of them was filled with angst.
Oh, okay.
One of them was not.
Yes, yeah. Kahneman as opposed to Tversky, but that you're this goy who
walks into this world that's not my world.
Yeah, exactly.
The source of insecurity I had with the story was not the fact that they were Jewish and I was a goy, because I, in fact, I was raised in some ways as a Jewish person. I went to a Jewish school from age 5 to 18, the Isidore Newman School in New Orleans, Louisiana. It started as a manual training center for Jewish orphans, and 50% of my, actually 75% of my class was Jewish to about the sixth grade, and half of my class from then on. And so I grew up in a very Jewish environment. So it's never feel, Judaism never feel alien to me. The problem was they were so smart.
Yeah.
That I felt I was in the presence of people whose minds were just capable of doing things that mine was not. And, you know, it is like, when the B student's trying to describe the A students, exactly, the B student will naturally leave stuff out. And so I was uncomfortable. It took me a little, the way this insecurity expressed itself is it took me longer than any book I've done to actually accept the fact that I was going to write the book. Hmm. I gathered material for 8 years and was in and out of it. Yeah, I'm going to do it. No, I'm not going to do it. Danny Kahneman, I think at one point just got convinced it's never going to happen. Hmm. He's just not going to do it. It just took me a long enough time before. And what happened was then I'd spent so much time with it. I'd gotten the equivalent of a graduate degree in psychology. At some point I realized I kind of know this stuff. I know enough about this and enough already. And I did think that I was also at the point in my mind where I realized that if I didn't write it, nobody would, because one of the protagonists was already dead and the other one was 85 years old and he'd let me in and they let me in. So I was in a privileged position.
But you did talk about how the ghost of Tversky sort of haunted you, because you believed he wouldn't have thought of you as...
Oh, he wouldn't. I think yeah, he would have...
He would have disapproved of you as being nothing, the author.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
You know, his family disagrees with me a bit on this. But I think what he would have disapproved of the exercise generally. I think he might have said to me, Michael, if anybody's going to do it, I'll let you do it, but I just don't really want to do this. I think that's what he would have said. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing good's going to come of this, mm-hmm, is what he would think. And Danny thought that a bit too. My pitch to Danny and my pitch to Amos was, yeah, you might be right that nothing good's going to come of this, but somebody's going to do it. And they may do it after you're dead. And you know me, and it could be a lot worse. And he kind of bought that argument. I think that's why he kind of agreed to let me poke around in stuff that Amos really wouldn't want me poking around it. And Danny didn't really want me poking around, because the relationship was fraught, you know, and in some ways, Danny, I think, was a little upset with me just because the whole enterprise forced him to relive a part of his life he just assumed not. Mm.
So one of the themes, as I mentioned, across some of your books is the complexity and issues with the financial markets. You've also, there are another series of books that are very personal. Mm-hmm. Liar's Poker also qualifies in that. Coach, Lessons on the Game of Life, was about Coach Fitz, your baseball coach. Mm-hmm. The Blind Side, you grew up with Sean Tuohy.
He's in Coach.
Ah, yeah, yeah, right.
He's in it because he has a line. When he looks over after we have Coach Fitz for we are in the seventh grade and we're practicing on a basketball court next to the eighth grade. And we have our own coach, not Coach Fitz, and the eighth graders have Coach Fitz as a coach. And Sean, after we watch he's like, Coach Fitz is like running these people ragged and they're all kind of laying on the court prostrate, and Sean looks over and says, please God, don't let me get to the eighth grade. He's like, I don't want to ever have to do that. But then Sean ended up being the point guard, and Fitz was the high school basketball coach too, and they won two state championships together.
Wow.
And there's a wonderful picture when they won the second one with Sean in his arms. So you're right. The Blind Side ends up being a little personal for that reason. Yeah.
And then the four, just to close it out, Home Game being another one, just cool, about, you know, your own personal experiences with fatherhood and so on.
Right.
So you've got, you know, I'm not that, what I think is really interesting is you defy kind of there's no through line on all of the books.
I mean, there
isn't. It is your own experience, but you've got a series of these where you were interested enough in your personal experience to go down a path towards
developing a book.
Yeah. I guess I've got a broader question about your methods or your process, but also, you know, what drew you to some of this content that came from your own personal life?
So, I'll answer the second one first.
Yeah, please. Thanks.
In each case, it was just a niggling sense that even though it was trivial and it was just me, that there was something in the experience that was rich and exploitable for literary purposes. With the kids, it was just there. It was the early part of parenthood when I was very clearly not experiencing the emotions you were supposed to experience. And it was annoying my wife. And it was mildly disturbing to me, but it was just like a little odd. I thought, this isn't what it was supposed to feel like. And so I started that's an opportunity. It's like, describe then what you do feel like, because that's going to be different from what people expect. And that's probably, there are a lot of other people who feel the same way. It just had nobody wants to say it. And it was also a way to turn that part of our lives when we were, you know, there were just limits to how much travel I could do and, into material, right?
Yeah.
Each kid has a book, in that with each kid, I was rushing to a deadline before the birth, because I knew the minute the birth happened, I was done for months and months and months and months. So Quinn was born in 99. That was a new thing. Dixie was born in 2002. That was Moneyball. And Walker was born in 2006. That was The Blind Side. Mm. And it was just like pedal to the metal, haul ass to the deadline, because life was going to be over. Mm. And it was right. Mm. Life was over like 6 months after they were born. In each of the personal stories, there's something that, like, I just thought, yeah, it may be just me who feels this way, but I feel this way very strongly. And I sense that if I got that feeling on paper, there'd be a lot of other people who felt this way, and it isn't just me. Mm-hmm. The coach was, this guy who changed my life was going to be fired from the school because the parents of the current players weren't letting him change their lives in the same positive way. Mm-hmm. That was just bizarre. The process broadly is very messy. Like, no business school would teach it. No writer's program would teach it. I do just wander. I just feel like I'm a wanderer in the world. And I try to encounter a lot of stuff in print, on the internet, at dinner parties, at conferences. I just try to kind of get myself in situations where I'm talking to people about a lot of different things. And I just, when I hit something that I feel really interested in, I think I'll write something about it and we'll see where it goes. It's everything I've written started small. It started with, this is just a little thing. And the books just mushroomed. They mm-hmm. just, you know, when I went to see Billy Bean, it really started with just me shooting the shit with the New York Times editor, magazine editor at the time, about salary discrepancies on the field. I was curious, if I got myself into the Oakland A's clubhouse, if I'd find class resentment. Mm-hmm. If the guys who were being paid $8 million were being resented by the guys who were being paid $300,000, because that had happened, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just led to what, I mean, it's something I've been looking at. Actually, I don't want to blow the material, but I've been watching a lot of college basketball lately. Mm-hmm. And there's this discrepancy now on the court between the coaches, just a couple of teams that have five NBA players who are one and done, mm-hmm. and a team that's a team. And most of those guys are not going to have careers playing basketball, but they can sometimes beat those other guys. Mm-hmm. And the strategies that are involved in either case really interest me. So that's a magazine piece. Mm-hmm. I might go find one coach of one type and one coach of the other type and just how they play that hand.
Yeah.
We're going to play, that's going to be the hand we play. How do we play it the best we play it, can play it?
It's akin to, isn't it, when some of the European squads were beating the Americans in like international competitions.
Yes. How's that happen?
Yeah.
Right.
Clearly the better teams were losing.
Right. It gets interesting when that happens.
Yeah.
But what will happen is I get into a story and I'll find the character is just a really interesting character. And the situation is a bigger situation than I expected. And I'll call the magazine or whoever is funding me for the R&D. And I'll say, either there's going to be a little thing, I'm going to get it out of the way, or you got to wait because it's a book. But it's like right now, I don't have a next book project. I have all these things that I make little folders when I think there might be something interesting to, I don't want to forget it. Mm. I toss it over there, and once every 3 months, I'll go through that pile and it will all seem Like I won't remember any of it. It'll be stuff that just I jotted down in a moment.
And it includes books. So there's like little books.
Yeah. That sometimes, are in there as well? Sometimes I'll go through it and I'll say it'll. So let's pick one.
Yeah. Please. This is great.
So it's I don't even, I haven't looked at this in months, but it's.
So it's a manila folder with all sorts of notes and a book and.
This is a folder on teaching kids about money. I'm toying with the idea of writing about teaching my kids about money, because they don't know anything and they do crazy things. And every now and then I run across something, an article or a receipt from a child, or that I think this is material. I don't want to, if I ever do this, I need this stuff. And each one of these folders has stuff that's been just kind of accumulated, and sometimes it will actually happen. So Kahneman Tversky was a folder like that for 6 years, and then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. I have a trunk full of material for a New Orleans kind of memoir. It's down in the basement, and maybe one day I'll haul that out. You know, something will spark my interest in that. But there's a lot of kindling here.
Yeah.
And it's just a question of where the fire comes from. Because you really got to care about it. I find that if I don't care about it, it's not going to be any good. And a lot of the stuff just never happens because in my mind, it's ended up being kind of inert material. If it's been done real well by someone else, or I just, for whatever reason, lose interest in it. So
is there enough? There are probably, it looks like, 5 or 6 different manila folders there.
No, you're missing them.
Oh, see, is there all there? These things? Oh, all those little, they're yeah.
Probably 40.
They don't yet have books or receipts from children.
Yes, right. They're probably like 40 of them there.
Got it.
And is there
enough of a kernel in your mind for most of those to know that, that's a, because I what you just showed me, there's books, there's receipts, there's like things you clearly found like when you're out and about in the world.
Right. So they're probably, of the 40 folders there, one or two might happen, but I just don't want to forget them. If something catches my interest, I want to at least note that and just put it away for maybe coming back to it. It's not like, I don't think, a book has to be, you're right. People have tried to like explain all my books, and if you write enough of them, you can't really do that.
Right.
They're very different things. Yeah. And it's like trying to explain all your kids. If you have 15 kids, they're going to be different enough that there's no theory to explain how they all are.
But it does require a reputation like yours to
have the right to do it.
Exactly right. Because I think a lesser author will be forced into a swim lane.
So the lucky points in my life that lead to the right to write about anything I want is one. The first book I write, Liar's Poker, is about a subject I am not inherently passionate about. I become passionate about it because it's me and I'm in that world, but I didn't care about money. I still don't care about money. I mean, I'm not a money person. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking about it all the time. And so I already in my head knew that I could take material that was not like deep inside me, wasn't part of my childhood experience, wasn't something I grew up to do, and turn it into something that really worked. So I knew I could write about anything. If I could pull that off, I could pull off anything. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody else did. They all, for a long while, for a year, mm-hmm. several years, it was like, you're a Wall Street writer. You're a business writer. Mm-hmm. The New Republic let me loose from 1990 to 1996 in all kinds of directions, and stuff really succeeded as magazine pieces that were just very different things from anything I'd ever done. Essays on all kinds of subjects that were just not, you know, obviously my subject. And a book came out of a journal I kept as I roamed around the 96 presidential campaign. And that, while not a giant commercial success, was a big critical success. So that sort of established, well, politics and money. And then the categories just ended. When the idea that I had to confine myself to such a category ended when Moneyball was published. And my editor at Norton, Star Lawrence, I give him a lot of credit. He said, if you care that much about it, go do it. And from then on, nobody's really asked me, is this a book for you? Like, is this material for you? I've asked myself. And so my in conversations with Star, the conversations with Star were critical in me gaining the confidence to write The Undoing Project. Because I did think, I did think, really, Star, I'm so over my skis here. I am the B student. I would, they would never would have thought, if I were their student, that I was the person to write about them. There's so many smarter people in this field. And he would just say, no, there are lots of reasons to think you can do this. It's really about these guys, the characters, and you've done characters like them before. You know, so it's now gotten to the point where I'm not, I'm the closest thing to the break on me approaching new material, because I think maybe I'm not suited to do that. And my editor will take my interest in such subjects and say, just go do it.
But what's so interesting, I love that you listed the Moneyball and the Undoing Project together, because, of course, one led to the other.
Absolutely.
Right? So Moneyball comes out, enormous success, critical success, becomes a movie. And
so that's the other thing that happened. The movies changed my career.
Right. Exactly. Right. That's a completely different level. You've had three now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But just what happens when it sells so many books and you get to so many people, you get to an audience that doesn't naturally grab for a book. Mm-hmm. And you all of a sudden have an industry that is about telling popular stories, that's looking at everything you do as a possible movie. Mm-hmm. And that creates a certain energy. I mean, it sort of validates, merely because I've written about it. Someone will buy it thinking they can turn it into a movie, and they can't all the time, but it validates the material in some way in the publisher's mind, in the reader's mind, and that's been a huge benefit, to have the movie industry interested in what I write. But anyway, you're right. Moneyball and the Undoing Project are organically linked.
Yeah, exactly. And what I find is, and I want to cover both of those, both just terrific books, maybe we talk about that connection first. So Moneyball comes out. It is the critical success that it is. But you do receive some criticism.
Oh my God.
That you're basically telling a story that you are treating as new material, something that has already really been covered in great depth, but a topic that you were not aware of, if I recall it correctly.
With Moneyball?
No. So the work of Kahneman and Tversky actually predates a lot of what was covered in Moneyball.
Oh, yes? Right. Correct.
Yes, that's the criticism. Why is there no reference in all of Moneyball to these two people?
So the genuine hostility to Moneyball came from inside of baseball, from people who were afraid they were going to lose their jobs. And in fact, in many cases, did lose their jobs because there was this new thing happening that was the analytics revolution.
Yes.
And that they weren't really equipped to contribute to. And it was hostile, directly hostile to the way they were making decisions. Mm-hmm. But there was that kind of criticism I could dismiss. It was self-interested and basically wrong, I thought. The criticism I could not dismiss was delivered much more gently and sweetly and in a loving shell. And it was only from a review by Richard Thaler, Nobel Prize winning economist now, and Cass Sunstein, in which they said how much they liked the book. But it was, the author didn't seem to understand it. It essentially was a case study from Kahneman of the work of Kahneman and Tversky. And I really didn't know. Kahneman won his Nobel Prize the year I was working on Moneyball, but I didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. And I should have paid attention, but you know, I did know when I was working on Moneyball that behavioral economics had this influence on the A's front office. But I never bothered to ask where behavioral economics came from.
Right.
And that it had come from psychology. And I never really drilled down to ask what's going on in the minds of the people who make the mistakes about the baseball players, the old scouts. And I was aware, if I have any like trace of guilt about the way I wrote the Moneyball story, is it left the reader with the possibility of thinking that just the baseball people are stupid. Like they're just stupid people. And smart people don't make these mistakes. But what Kahneman and Tversky show is everybody makes these mistakes. It's not smart, stupid. It's like the way people are wired. And I like the baseball scouts, personally. Really like them, actually. And I didn't think they were stupid. But they were making these mistakes. I could have resolved that in a way that left the baseball scouts less exposed to the charge of stupidity. And it would have been a more interesting story. That this isn't just these guys making this mistake. Everybody makes this mistake. And plus, I didn't classify the mistakes as rigorously as I could have if I'd known the work of Kahneman and Tversky, because they had classified them all. So that's what got me interested in their intellectual work. Never would have written a book about them, or even a magazine piece probably, if that had been the extent of it. What really got me jazzed about the material was the two guys. They were literary characters. So that's, it was a case of kind of dipping into their work with a feeling of guilt that I missed this thing. And what the hell is it about? And, oh, that's interesting. I should have known that. To mentioning it over drinks with one of my best friends in the world, Dacher Keltner, a psychologist here, with whom I had drinks last night in the very same place, probably the same table. We meet there once a month. And saying to him that, I had some people in your field who, and it's kind of interesting. He goes, he said, I was Amos Tversky's teaching assistant, and Danny lives up the hill. He says, you need to get to know these people. And he hooked me up by email with Danny, and I went up, and it was just social. I just thought, interesting. But everything that came out of his mouth was so interesting. I just kept coming back. And I didn't know where it was going to go until I realized that basically I'd walked into this great, this historically great and unusual love story between these two guys.
Yeah.
Non-sexual, but right. Passionate.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of get that down and get the ideas across to people who maybe wouldn't totally understand Thinking Fast and Slow. Because he was writing that the whole time I was. He was writing and then throwing it away. He told me three times, I'm done. The book's not worth doing. It's going to destroy my reputation. I mean, this book is still on the bestseller list.
Yeah.
But like 20 years later, it's crazy that book almost didn't happen.
Right.
And if that book had not happened, I would be so famous. Because all those people would have had to come to my book to get a digestible version of their ideas, because they were just in academic papers.
Right.
But it would have been a horrible travesty if I was the one, really the one.
The only one famous for this.
Yeah, that would have been horrible. That would have been hard to sleep at night. Danny had to get talked out of it, like, just throwing it all away by his agent. It is amazing.
Which is the way he's oriented, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
He's like looking for what's wrong.
Yeah.
With everything he does, finding the reason it's bad. But curiously, also alive to the proposition that when someone else says something, no matter how wrong it is, there might be something right in it. Mm. So he's very generous with other people and the nonsense that comes out of their mouths. But very ungenerous with his own thoughts and words. Mm-hmm. It's a funny combination. Mm-hmm. Most people the opposite, right? Most people think what they said was smart and what everybody else said was stupid, and are happy with that arrangement because it leaves them in their status intact. Danny's got this curious source of status where he realizes his way is smarter. Like looking for the intelligent things that are coming out of other people and trying to be critical of yourself actually is a much smarter way to go through the world. And he's also just wired that way. He's a little insecure, wants to please people, and is doubtful about himself. So he's just amped that up into a way of being. And it's very, 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 it's like an intellectual superpower. It's funny. His graduate students, I mean, now they're famous professors, but the language with which they spoke about him was that language. It was like he's got these superpowers. You got to realize you're not talking about a guy. You're talking about Superman or Batman or Spider-Man. He's got the thing. He can make himself invisible. You know, but it's with his mind. And it's just different. Because don't have that superpower. When I would see him, I'd come away with this glow of having been in the presence of this. And gradually I would reduce it to so it would fit inside my brain. the stuff that was coming out of his brain. And that's it was in reducing it, I made it something less. And that feeling, and knowing that I'd done that, that feeling was made me feel very insecure about writing the story. Mm. Like, I can't get my mind around all that. I can't get all the glow from that planet into my literary, you know, vessel. Mm-hmm. I can only get some of it. There's so much of it, it was enough, mm. I think. I loved, it's funny. I have usually nothing but a kind of dead feeling towards books after they're done. Like, I don't want to read them again. I've never read any of them again. Don't like pick them up and look at them and see how. I just no interest. And I've sort of digested the material and I'm done with it. I reread this one when I was done with it. And I really thought, I was so pleased with it. Mm. I mean, in a way that is unseemly.
And was it relief because of the insecurity you had going into it? Or?
No, I just love the story.
Yeah.
And I thought, and I really love the story. And I just thought, books, you put them out in the world, like kids, and what happens to them is unfair. Both ways. Good things happen that shouldn't happen. Bad things happen that shouldn't happen. They have their fate in the world. They run across an ordinary reviewer in a prominent place who shouldn't be reviewing the book. And that's that. So most of my books, I would say, have done better than they should have done. I feel that way about most of them. There are two, and The Blind Side, I feel that way about now because of the movie. Mm-hmm. When that came out, it was very disappointing. But this one, this was the one I really felt like the world won't ever completely like it as much as it should. Mm. That I like it more than the world likes it.
Is it your favorite? Would you put it?
No, it's like having a kid. It's like having your kid, a kid who's kind of like differently abled. I feel this book is differently abled. Mm. It can really do, like, it can really sing some notes that the other books don't sing, and people don't all hear that note. It's complicated from whatever it is. It just didn't quite get to the audience I thought it was going to get to. And although it did very well, but mm-hmm. it didn't. So it's sort of like some kids you send off into school and they come back and the teachers all like them and they get A's, but you kind of realize, well, you know, just because they get A's doesn't mean they're that smart. You know, they're not saying that. And some kids go into school and they come back with 3 A's and 2 F's. And they'll lighten up your mind when you talk to them. And this, it's because of the guys and the material. It just lit up my mind. And I, so it is an odd case. It's the one case where I was pleased enough with it to go back and reread it and be pleased all over again. Mm. And it was hard to do. Mm.
So the longest of your books, right?
Probably is the longest. Still not that long, but yeah, it probably is the longest. Tell you what, it you're right in this way too. Most of the time, I say to the publisher, I'm going to deliver you 90,000 words or 100,000 words, and I'm right on. I mean, it's weirdly right on, like within 500 words. Mm-hmm. Like somehow I kind of had a sense of what the scope of the thing was, and that's what came in. This one just kept expanding, and I had to, different kind of experience. Like I didn't have complete control of the material. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, it's like, I knew it's got some structural flaws to it that I could never figure out how to completely solve. The big structural flaw is that I didn't want to fix it because fixing it would have meant getting rid of what I wanted to have in the book that I really wanted to kick out from them to other things to show their effects in the world. And it's hard for a reader to follow that sometimes. Hmm. But I guess, so the broad way I feel about it is my favorite book. No, but because I don't really have one.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, you know, when I'm judging the books, not just on how they came out, but on the degree of difficulty, this gets the highest degree of difficulty score. It was the hardest book to do. And maybe that's why I was so pleased with it. Like it got done. And maybe because I'd spent 6 years thinking I couldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So that may be part of it too.
It's interesting how, you know, proximity, So you had access to Kahneman because he happened to be here.
Yeah.
Same thing with Billy Bean, this extraordinary story that is right in your backyard practically.
Well, it's a pretty extraordinary place. So there,
yeah. Where you are here.
This whole area. I mean, there's so much ferment. Mm-hmm. When my wife and I were trying to decide where we were going to settle down, and we decided, like right up front, there's a baby on the way and a family on the way, and we want to be in a place. One of the things we talked about is like, where can we be where I don't have to be on airplanes all the time for book material, where some of the book material might be, you know, driving distance. And without knowing what that material was, it was here or New York, and we didn't want to live in New York. But here, really, if you think about what this place has generated for me, some of it's not obvious. 2/3 of The Big Short was here. Michael Berry was in San Jose, and the guys at Cornwall Capital were down in a garage in Berkeley. So two of the three main characters were here. Moneyball was obviously here. The new thing was here. Mm-hmm. The Blind Side, the core story was in Memphis, but the intellectual story about what had happened in football was Bill Walsh and the 49ers front office. There's a 49er player who's prominent in it. The 49ers front office was the analytics leader at the moment, and they helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. So if you, every book or a lot of the books have, there's something about this area really helping with it. And the Undoing Project, I mean, now you're right. I had Danny here. Amos's archives were in Stanford, and two or three of the world's experts on who those people were, I can walk to their houses. So it's really, it's an interesting place. A lot of stuff going on. And material that, you know, it's filled with people who are disrupting their environment one way or the other here, and everybody celebrates that. That ends up being pretty good literary material.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is really extraordinary about Moneyball is the meta story that is there, that you have this general manager who was the number one pick in a baseball draft.
He was a first round pick.
Oh, forgive me. He was not number one.
He was going to be number one, but he said he was going to Stanford, and he kind of, they smelled, oh, he may go to college instead.
Yeah. So it could have been.
So the Mets had the one pick and like the 20th pick in the draft, both first round. And it was, did they take Daryl Strawberry or Billy Bean? And if Billy had been all in, they'd have taken Billy Bean.
Interesting.
So
five tool.
Right.
Out of central casting.
Right.
You know, looked like a baseball star.
Right.
And what's fascinating about this is, in essence, he wants to build a system to make sure that he does not choose a Billy Bean.
Correct.
That meta story, I find, is just absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, but so that's, you know, there's no way you find that out unless you're there already. You're not going to just hear about that and go write a book about it. And I don't really discover that because he was really good at downplaying just how traumatized he was by not having gone to Stanford. I mean, he really he struggled in baseball. I mean, he got to the big leagues. Mm-hmm. He was such an athlete. He kind of, you know, he just like muscled his way into the big leagues, but he didn't really have a successful big league career. And there was the whole time in the back of his mind, Christ, he has a whole nother, it's the nature of regret. You start imagining alternative realities, right? How could I have avoided that car accident? When something really bad happens, Kahneman, Tversky, they were starting to play with these ideas. Like, how do people, what are the rules of undoing? Like, how do you undo that thing? And Billy had real regrets almost right from the beginning that he had not gone to college. He's really smart. He really likes educated people. He sensed, I'm not going to be one. Plus, at the time, John Elway was a quarterback at Stanford, and they had flagged Billy as the guy to replace him. He'd have been the quarterback at Stanford after. And I think he's probably more suited to play free safety, but he might have had an NFL career that would have been he's fast and big. And mm-hmm. So he has this alternative life still that he thinks about that was screwed up by the misvaluations that baseball placed on people. That baseball's inability to see that he wasn't really a superstar baseball player screwed up his life, and that he's now seeking revenge by turning that whole valuation system on his head. It's really great. But it took a while, like quite a while, to get to that story. Mm-hmm. And it really was the other people in the front office who said, you know, You might want to ask him about that. That there really is this other thing that bothers him a lot, but he doesn't really talk about it. And it took a while to get him to talk about it at all. But it did make it. It's like when that those things happen, when you're working on a story, you just think there is a God. You know, it's just like, thank you, God. That material is so good. You know, it just so enriches the story. Gives the main character this. It makes it a movie. You know, Brad Pitt reads it and says, in a funny way, I think what he says is, I see myself a little in this because I'm extremely good looking. So I get the extremely good looking guy roles when what I really am is an actor. What I really am is like a character actor. But I got to play these, you know, my job is to carry the picture as the handsome guy. I'm misunderstood by the system. I mean, I don't think it's a tragedy in Brad Pitt's case, but I think he sensed it. I think a lot of people sense it. They feel like the world does not value me properly, and they're right, right?
You stay in touch with a lot of your subjects, and I imagine you probably have with Billy Bean.
All of them.
And is there any regret on his part that your book made his methods? It would have come out, I'm sure, at some point, somehow, but it made it accessible. Your book changed the way in which sports really was organized. So one could certainly argue, certainly baseball as well.
So from his point of view, he wasn't thinking this way because he didn't know what I was doing until he read the book. He saw me wandering around Major League Baseball, spending a lot of time with him, but I went to the Rangers and I went to the Blue Jays and I went to the Red Sox, and he saw me. He didn't know what my story was. I was going to those places to make sure the A's were as different as I thought they were. But if he had known what I was doing, he might even have said, it's not that big a deal. The timing is right. Because what was about to happen was the Red Sox were about to do this. They had seen what I had seen, in particular John Henry, who just bought the Red Sox, who was a Wall Street guy. He knew exactly what they were doing. And he was going to make a noisy display of doing the same thing with three times the money. He to the point where he was trying to hire Billy to run his team. And Billy for a day took the job and then backed out. But so the narrative, I think the true narrative is, had I not written the book, what would have happened is the Red Sox would have won the World Series, probably with even a greater intellectual advantage because no one had the book. And they would have gotten all the credit for the analytics revolution. And people would have said, oh, the Oakland A's, they never won, right? So I think that, so in a funny way, it preserved the real story. And it didn't, I don't think it actually, I think Billy might say, and he's be no better than I, but I think what he might say is it just sped things up a bit. That this was all going to happen. It was all going to happen pretty fast. But so instead of happening in 7 years, it happened in 4 years. And we were always going to be trampled by the wave of geeks that came into the game. So I think the advantages were going away already. The inefficiencies were going away already. And that wasn't what he was upset about when he read the book. It didn't even occur to him. It really didn't occur to him, because I asked him eventually, and he said, nobody in baseball is going to read your book. That's what he said. He said that was his first response. That won't do it. They don't read. He was wrong about that. The owners read it.
Yeah.
They all read it.
Yeah. And they all
realized. That's exactly what happened. You go back and you see, and if you look around the league, Jeff Luhnow now was hired by the Cardinals. He's now at the
Astros.
Yeah. On the back of the book, he told me. Farhan, who's now running the Giants, but was running the Dodgers. Andrew Friedman at the Tampa Bay. I think all these owners got it because it was a new kind of rich guy who owned teams. It was someone who was either Wall Street money or tech money, who was not afraid of data and could see that. It made it more fun for them, right? They could sometimes their money, their fortunes were built on, you know, by exploiting inefficiencies, by better using data, and they could bring the same skill set to their teams. It's like a bonus they didn't expect to have. They thought they were going to be kind of the awkward person in the room with all these old baseball guys talking about stuff that they didn't really understand. that's the thing. But it turns out, no, you can guide the discussion. So that was very appealing, I think, to the owners.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Lewis, thank you so much for taking time with me today, sharing a bit about your journey as an author, the processes you use, the rationale and stories behind some of the great books that you've written. It's been a great conversation. And to our listeners, this is part one of a two-part series in my interview with Michael Lewis. Look for part two coming in the weeks ahead.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Phil Finucane, the Chief Technology Officer of Express Scripts.